Okay. Hello, everyone. We are back with another episode of Vaccine Curious, and I'm Tracy Bethert, and I'm joined by Christine Stableben. And today we're really excited to have a guest with us, Ram Durasetti. He is a good friend of mine and has recently also been doing research with Christine Stableben. And so Ram is an MD, PhD. I guess all three of us are. I just realized that. And you did your undergrad at Stanford, did your MD at University of Michigan, if I understand correctly, and your PhD at Stanford in computational decision making. And you're currently an emergency medicine physician in pediatrics. And I know you just got off
general,
the ship.
General emergency medicine, yes.
General emergency medicine, sorry. Okay. So you see adults and children.
I do. I see adults and children. And when I was working clinically at Stanford, I saw exclusively kids. I was in the pediatric ER, and that was probably for about 17 years, 16 to 17 years, I worked exclusively in the pediatric ER. Around that amount of time, maybe a little bit more. But, I had a pediatric specific practice at Stanford, and outside of that, it's adult and pediatrics.
And so we're actually going to talk a little bit about how you were at Stanford, and then because of the booster mandate, actually a similar situation to Martin Kulldorff and Aaron Cariotti, you actually ended up losing your position there. And I think we'll get to that. I want to introduce you a little bit more because we got to know each other actually through Urgency of Normal. And I think of some listeners may have learned about you then because you did a really good job comparing the infection fatality rate of COVID-19 in children to influenza and really kind of put that in perspective. I think for a lot of people that depending on the year, influenza could actually be more severe per infection for children. And then you really were right about a lot of things in the pandemic. And I would say, I know that since you joined Urgency of Normal. But you could talk about that. And then we've also had three publications together. One in the New England Journal of Medicine, where we talked about healthy vaccine bias, and exposed the Clalit Health researchers for basically covering up a very large bias in their study of the Pfizer booster against mortality in adults. And basically what they hid was a very large health benefit among the boosted that made the vaccine appear much more effective than it very likely was. And again, that's called healthy vaccine bias. And then, and we published that with Vinay Prasad. And then we've also had a systematic review of child masking in the British Medical Journal, as well as a preprint where we reanalyzed the Cowger et al. Study of the Boston masking study. And that's hopefully going to be coming out in some form soon in a peer-reviewed journal. So tell us about sort of your clinical experience with COVID and sort of, I want to hear about how you got interested in sort of advocating and joining Urgency of Normal and how you got involved in the research that you did.
Yeah. So, around 2006, I resigned my salary position at Stanford. I retained my faculty position. I went to per diem status. You mentioned, like, my last publication at that time, significant publication, and I did some with residents thereafter. But my last significant one was the one you mentioned you went through in one of your epidemiology courses with the pulmonary embolism D-dimer analysis. And honestly, while I'm really grateful that got published, it was a lot of work because it was a very technical paper, a lot of code, a lot of analytics, mathematics that I had to really strip down in ways to get it to a wider audience. I could have published it in an informatics journal, but that isn't what I wanted. I think what was really satisfying about that was being able to take a robust modeling technique, do a robust sensitivity analysis, and then years later, people performed clinical trials that basically validated the findings, which I thought was kind of cool. But I have to say that I got pretty disillusioned with academics fairly early on. And I really have not been involved in the publication process, except here and there, helping people on stats, papers here and there. And then COVID came along. I think I just didn't have an intellectual motivation that overcame what I had come to develop as a bit of a disdain for the academic process, academia in general. And I think, honestly, much of what I learned or experienced, a lot of people have come to know more over the last 4 years, for better or for worse. So, but, you know, COVID came along, and I had questions for myself. I mean, I had a three-month-old, about three-month-old, 3 or 4 month-old at that time. And, you know, the very original questions in March. We had a wedding right before to attend, right before the lockdowns were started, a wedding in Paso Robles. And I was like, do I die? Where was my three-month-old? That's right. I mean, you know, when we talk about respiratory infections in the very young and the very old, that's what we're talking about, susceptibility. They're immune naive. They don't have a great airway reflex. They don't have a particularly strong cough. There's increased chest wall compliance in the kid. There's lots of variables that make them more susceptible to, for example, tenacious secretions or a syncytia forming virus like SARS-CoV-2 or RSV. So I wanted to see if this we could attend this wedding. And so that's when I started diving into the data more. And, you know, I think I've often expressed this to people that, you know, I'm not young. I'm in my 50s. And when COVID started, I was, you know, close to my 50s. So you know, when people talked about the age grading with COVID and what have you, it was often pitched in terms of, like, the average working age adult, which clearly it's not, right? We all understand that. Or at least most of us. But at the time, I had a significant self-interest as well. I am a quote-unquote frontline physician. I'm an emergency physician. There's no such thing as me being shielded from aerosolized procedures. There's no such thing as me being shielded from exposure. And my higher volume clinical practice, which is community, which is adult and pediatrics, we receive all airport traffic from SFO. All of it, ambulance traffic. And so you can imagine that as, you know, being one of the three main ports of entry and possibly one of the top two, if not the top, maybe second only to LA, why I would have a particular concern about understanding what my risk was. And there's a period of time, and, you know, emergency medicine, you often do shifts and spurts. And so there's a period of time I was off, and people were talking about increasing cases. Now, I'll be totally honest. I had a little anxiety. I'm not an anxious person. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm like many degrees separated from, I would say, an average level of anxiety or certain of concern in general. But having said all that, you know, one of the things I learned very on was exposure is therapy. And what I mean by that is that you get out there, you see what this is, you learn the data, and you come to understand what it is you are or are not dealing with. And for me, when I see patients at volume, you know, people will say, yes, that's you're talking about your clinical anecdotes, but it's not really clinical anecdotes. I've seen probably about 180 to 200,000 patients in my lifetime. I haven't done the exact number. Or when I say lifetime of career, which spans over a very large period of time over a wide range of ailments, over a wide range of you know, some fraction of the 220 some odd respiratory viruses that are out there. So I when I practice clinically, I am constantly updating the Bayesian fashion, right? Everything I do is informed by the volume of data that I see and how it does or does not corroborate with what I see in the literature or what I read in the literature or what I download from a website or our world of data or whatever. So anyway,
what were you seeing in the ER? How did that match up with what you were hearing about?
Well, I mean, of course, you know that in the outset, there just wasn't really a lot of disease activity in California early on in March, April, May. We had a very tiny uptick, probably around May, if I recall, but it was very limited. And what I do remember is in December of 2019 and January of 2020, even in early February, because we had a lot of people coming back from conventions and other sort of large gatherings where I was seeing a lot of influenza PCR negative ILI, influenza-like illness.
Mm-hmm.
People forget at this time there was no general recommendation for masking. There was no use of N95s. The only reason I was using an N95 is that contact tracing was not enforced if you were wearing one when you saw a patient. There was some kind of specific stipulation. I'm like, I can't afford to miss work. If I don't work, I gotta get paid, and I have two households to support, I'm just wearing it. So it was fascinating how things evolved. People just don't remember. They don't remember.
Right. You hadn't been wearing N95s for upper respiratory illnesses before, and neither had I. And it is strange how people seem to have forgotten that. And that was, of course, based on the randomized studies that we had going into COVID.
That's right. And even beyond that, like, you know, this was a time where I started also looking into, like, you know, why is it that something that seems fairly obvious, meaning I wear a barrier over my face, and why wouldn't it decrease transmission? It seems obvious that it should, right? I mean, so I kind of delved into the whole notion of aerosol versus droplet spread, and what do N95s really do about air changes per hour in hospitals versus residential. For, you know, those who don't know, it's 15 to 20 times higher in hospitals, and yet everyone in a residential, for example, at least in U.S. code, I'm sure it's not all that different in Denmark, but so kind of delving into all these different variables. I mean, we can talk about that paper I did with Waterloo that still is going to be submitted to an engineering journal after making the rounds of multiple medical journals, which we can also talk about. But these are wild times when you reflect back on them. There's a lot of uncertainty, just absolutely endless fear-mongering, and none of it comported with what I was seeing clinically, just none of it. And, you know,
not with the children, right? I remember you talked. Did you see, I mean, how much severe COVID did you see, well, in general, but also in children?
Look, remember that nationally, pediatric emergency department volumes dropped 70%. 70%. It got so bad that so many pediatric residents were going through training without getting adequate clinical exposure, clinical volume. It got very bad. And in terms
so there were so few people in the ER that it, so few children that it was like, because people were avoiding coming to the ER. Unless
well,
they had
that
children.
And also, they weren't spreading. I mean, there's, you know,
even
let's see.
Did.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, if you're not contacting the communicable disease model, you're not going to spread the illness. But the question is, are there other things that are going to happen? We can talk about immunity dead, et cetera, frequency infections, et cetera. But fundamentally, volumes were vanishing small. Who did I see getting affected by severe COVID? In the pediatric ER, first of all, the numbers are very small. They're just very small. Everyone saw at least one sick kid. But so many of the kids that were getting admitted were kids with neonatal fever. for example, which can come from any virus, and the admission is primarily precautionary, as we all know. You also saw kids, I mean, there were a lot of kids I know for a fact who were admitted for fever and a positive PCR that they would have not been admitted for had it been any other virus. That happened on numerous occasions, and I don't remember it happening so much at Stanford. I know it happened at multiple other facilities. But it did happen a few times at Stanford as well. Like, you know, a two-month-old fever. Well, this is a very young infant in this category of, you know, under 3 months, very young infant, immunologically immature, where we've been, where, you know, in the past, for example, we did a lot more testing on these individuals, and we kind of pulled away from that. But these are patients in which people would often, will often still argue for septic workup, short of a lumbar puncture, not necessarily performing that, but some form of a septic workup just for reassurance and risk stratification. But my point is, these are people that people get clinically worried about. These are kids people get clinically worried about, where now they have a positive PCR with this spooky new illness, and it's like, well, gee, what do we do?
Right, and we already knew early on that, you know, 35 to 45% of those were incidental, at least, that it was just a positive test, but
we've
it was
never
most likely due to something
for any
else.
Illness like this right. ever before.
Like this,
never
and we're
ever.
Still, you know, it's interesting because we're still at UCSF. I'm actually doing a study with Jean Noble now because they're still testing all the admissions.
What?
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Stanford. I know. I'm pretty sure that stopped at Stanford. It's definitely stopped within larger health
almost
systems.
Everywhere in the world at this point. Hopefully, but I want to get back to a couple points. I mean, you make so many good points, but one was like sort of just continuing to be exposed to patients, and that was so important for me too in terms of the fear because I'm like, I'm going to work every day. I'm seeing all these people and all these people are seeing lots of people and I'm not hearing or seeing horror stories, you know, and this is certainly not to say that COVID wasn't unfortunately deadly for some people and wasn't severe in some people, but it was more like right. And, but it's also like we can say that about so many diseases,
yes.
right? And so it wasn't, I wasn't seeing anything that was like, this is so different than anything that we've seen before. And so I always thought, you know, if teachers could have just stayed going to school, they wouldn't have built up so much fear about going back. And I actually think that's something that the Scandinavian countries did really well. And it just ended up working out well that once you go back and you see, you know, it's fine. There's nothing to be alarmed about here. It's kind of like normal life, you know, then people can accept it. But I want to also talk to you about what you said about research, because I find it so interesting because I really felt similarly to you that when I was in medical school, I had an opportunity to do a PhD in addition to the MD. And I was actually at Harvard doing research and I ended up passing on it because I was like, I'm not going to make any money. It's going to cost me. It's like, it's not going to be a good investment. I said to myself, I'd rather do residency first and then see what happens. And then I happened to move to Denmark, you know, after I started my ophthalmology residency in the U.S. And then suddenly it became a much better investment because in Denmark, I could raise my own money from private funds and do my PhD and get paid a normal doctor's salary. And we don't have that opportunity in the U.S. But then the other thing that was shocking to me, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this as well, is in Denmark, you can really have an idea of something that you're curious about and you really want to look into, and you can get funding to do that. Whereas in the U.S., that's not the research environment here. It's so much of it is about sort of finding a mentor and really doing what they want you to do. And I say that also because I was part of the rehab, the PM&R MSTP program, and they basically, you know, said, you know, you need to work on getting an NIH grant if you want to have funding. And what I wanted to research at the time, there was no way that the NIH was going to want to research it. And, you know, it was because it was about ultra marathon running and, you know, basically lots of factors related to that. But I just knew that wasn't going to sell. And so I kind of gave up. And so I basically left an academic job too and was just an affiliate like you were. So it's an interesting contrast with Denmark, but I'm curious to hear about your experience too.
Yeah,
sounds
so
like it was similar.
I think it was similar. I had a VA medical informatics fellowship for a period of time, and I guess I could have pursued the academic route, but here's the problem. If you don't have a lot of family or generational wealth, you honestly can't really afford to be an academic in the U.S. and have a family. Certainly not in the Bay Area. I was in a single-income household. So for me, back then, clinical faculty at Stanford were paid a pittance compared to the community. Now it's much more comparable. Now it's not all that similar. Frankly, I'm sure some of them listen to this will resent me saying this. It's not clinically difficult to work in an academic center compared to the community. It's much easier. You have a lot more distributed labor, and you can get a left toe and a right toe consult and whatever else they want to do. And you also really minimize your risk exposure. So for many reasons, the slightly smaller amount of remuneration now is easily compensated for by a myriad of other benefits. And I'm not even sure it's that much smaller anymore. But back then, it was huge. It was about a 50% cut, 50%, which is huge. And if you're a single income in the Bay Area, if you don't have a ton of generational family wealth to lean on, you can't do it. You simply can't, single income household. So for me, it wasn't just financial. It was also because I've maintained my academic affiliations throughout. Even now, while I don't have clinical privileges, I have my academic affiliation. How long that'll last, who knows? I don't know. But fundamentally, it was also some disillusionment with what is academic clinical medicine or academic medicine in general. And very early on, I saw a lot of numerical imprecision, a lot of poor hypothesis formulation, poor hypothesis testing, and I don't mean just numerical, I mean conceptually. I felt that a lot of the literature was rinse and repeat, dice a data set in 10 different ways, get 10 different papers out of it. I mean, these are the games, and they weren't really geared towards addressing really difficult clinical questions that are largely answered by big data. Electronic medical records were revolutionizing that, at least the data collection. But we're now decades into a fairly large EMR explosion. We still don't do big data very well. We just went through 4 years where the CDC did not set up an accurate data feed to get accurate vaccination data on individuals. I have to say, I'm sitting here, when you talk about kids and COVID clinical experience, even on the adult side, I mean, I put central lines in 90-year-old GI bleeders who were quote COVID positive. They weren't admitted for COVID. They were admitted for GI bleeds. I put in, I relocated. There's only so much I can share, for HIPAA reasons, but relocated joints in patients who were getting sedation. Because we had to do testing, we did testing, and we're all in the room, and the patient is getting sedated, aerosolized or what have you, and you're putting whatever, joint back in, they're COVID positive, and they're like, oh, I'm COVID positive. So seeing the are we allowed to swear on this, by the way, but seeing people
Please.
Claim that incidental COVID admissions or incidental COVID encounters were not a thing, just such a flaming pile of horse shit. It's just absolute horseshit. And anybody who was clinically active was claiming that immediately lost credibility with me because it was just so patently false. Just shockingly patently. Like, it was just an outright lie. And it either had to question if they actually worked. I mean, do you actually have any clinical contact in any volume? Or are you just a liar? I don't know which one it is.
So it sounds like your motivation to get involved in research was finally just that you were so angry.
Well, I just can't stand frauds and liars. I just can't stand frauds and liars. It is true, and that's true whether it's in medicine, politics or anything else. They just are triggering. And so if it's in my specific domain, given my background between sort of clinical decision making and sort of decision analysis and computational modeling of that, and then on the clinical side working in volume, it's like it's kind of in my wheelhouse as much as anything can be in my wheelhouse. And so, yeah, my sort of bullshit meter was like in the red zone for a very long time. And so, yeah, that was a good motivation.
Well, and so since we're talking about frauds and liars, I guess that lends well to talking about the study that you and Christine did, not because you both are frauds and liars, but because of the pharmaceutical industry has had a lot of control over the data that we have gotten about the COVID-19 vaccines and the information that the public has received about how safe and effective they are. And I actually think, you know, it fits with what you're saying about research and academia as well, because there's simply so much funding, you know, from the pharmaceutical industry in academia. And that's the sort of research that people in clinical medicine in the United States are really exposed to. It's not, unfortunately, it's not the independent research. There's, you know, there's a lot of incentive if you want to, you know, make money from a certain drug company to do research. And I see this with my colleagues and friends, but there's just no incentive to do the independent research.
Well, no one else is funding it, right? Almost no one else
right.
is funding it.
And even if you get the funding, the academic centers are hesitant to take it, and they don't want controversy. And I certainly learned that the hard way. But, you know, So I'm curious to hear about how this study came about, because we're gonna be talking about this basically a systematic review and meta-analysis that you and Christine Stableben, it was actually by Stina Hoffman et al. She was the first author, mostly from University of Southern Denmark. So it was mostly a Danish study with Ram Durasetti from Stanford joining, and you looked at the overall health effects of the mRNA COVID vaccines in children. And I mean, you found your paper is very interesting, although albeit not surprising to people who were looking at the original clinical trials, but you basically looked at the randomized studies that were used for the approval, of these vaccines in children. And you found, I mean, the results are interesting, and people who don't know the results might be somewhat disturbed by them, honestly. But who wants to start talking about? I mean, you found an increased relative risk of serious adverse events. I'm sorry, was it serious or severe? It was severe adverse events in the older children, which serious are the ones that we worry about a lot more because they are serious, but the severe is like a degree of severity of a type of adverse event. So it could be like a severe headache or severe pain, but it's basically like a grading of how severe it is. But then you also found this increased relative risk in the younger children of lower respiratory tract infections and RSV. And I guess infections, that was not, other infections besides COVID wasn't an outcome in the older children. I'm curious. I'd like to hear your.
I said a lot. I want Christine to talk a while.
Yeah. So actually, Tracy, you were the one bringing Ram and I together, because I was telling you about our idea for this study, which is very aligned with what we have done in other situations. I should say that our group is interested in what we have coined the non-specific effects of vaccines on other infections. We have seen in Africa that vaccines can affect the immune system more generally, and the risk of dying from other infections than the one that the vaccine is targeting. And for some vaccines, these effects are super beneficial. For other vaccines, and that's the non-live vaccines, we have seen that they may actually, while protecting against the vaccine disease, they can increase the risk, at least temporarily, for other infections until a new vaccine is given. So these non-specific effects are our main interest. And regrettably, from our point of view, any phase 3 trial or phase 4 trial or post-marketing surveillance, there are none of them that capture other infections, because based on the current understanding of the immune system, vaccines shouldn't affect the risk of other infections. So it's simply not part of the data collection in any of these assessments of vaccine safety to measure the effect on other vaccines. But you can indirectly capture that effect in the phase 3 trials if you look at the risk of the serious adverse events, or directly if the data sets are reporting, for instance, death or hospitalizations in these groups by course. So we have done, our group has made it a thing to go into the phase 3 trials and try to extract information from the phase 3 trials, where we, after all, have usually the best comparisons between vaccinated and unvaccinated or placebo recipients with regards to overall health outcomes. So this was something we have done a number of times before, and also wanted to do, also did for COVID vaccines to adults, and already published that paper, and then wanted to do with the phase 3 trials in children. And you told me that Bram was really interested in this work, so we contacted you, Bram, and was really happy to have you involved in this paper. You've come with invaluable input to the paper. So this was really how we got started on this trajectory of working together on this review that I'm happy to elaborate a bit on. Well, that was the background for the paper, yeah. At least.
Thank you. Well, that makes sense. And I'm so glad you connected, because Rem has been so great to work with. He really brings a lot of important skills to data analysis. And so, you know, it's our gain. It's the loss of, academia in the US that, they didn't get to have you as a top researcher. So, it's been great working with you, Ram, and I'm, yeah,
I concur with working with both of you. It's been great. It's been a good experience.
And so we'll get a little bit more into the study, because, I want to bring up a couple points. So basically, you guys looked at this, you did an analysis of, by age group of number needed to benefit and number needed to harm with these vaccines. That I found that really helpful and also interesting, because the only outcome with the benefits that we're looking at is a decreased risk of infection that lasts some amount of time, and that's against COVID-19, but we don't know how long that lasts, because these trials were very short. They were a matter of months. Now remind me, I think they were maybe 4 or 5 months maximum. Were they longer than that?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
Way.
The main problem here
also we should emphasize. The main problem we should emphasize with this is that the data collection for adverse events usually is within the first weeks of follow up, where they will ask for solicited adverse events, like the normal adverse events that a child would experience, with pain in the arm, redness, soreness, fever, fatigue, etc. And that only lasts for the first month of the trial. Then this solicited adverse events data collection stops, and the only data that are collected on non-COVID disease, and this is not specific for the COVID vaccines, this is for all phase 3 trials, the only data that is collected in the long run are on the target disease, in this case COVID-19, and then on serious adverse events, which will be those leading to hospitalizations or death. So that means that we have different length of follow-up for the various symptoms that the trials are reporting, which makes it a bit difficult, in fact, to calculate, or, you know, we can be, the numbers needed to benefit in terms of COVID-19 are for the full period of follow-up, but the numbers needed to harm, for instance, for severe adverse events, will be only for the first month. So it's really not very comparable. We are overestimating in the numbers needed to benefit, numbers needed to harm. We are overestimating the benefit of the vaccine, because it has simply had longer time
to see the benefits. Yeah. It yeah. really is an unfair comparison. Great for Pfizer and Moderna. I'm sure they like that, that now you're not able to compare the infections. But so even so, I mean, so you're looking at this, let's see, you had like a number needed to benefit to reduce your chance of COVID infection of like 40 to 115 children. And then this number needed to harm that was based on a much shorter time period. It was 215 for like a lower respiratory tract infection and 215 for a serious, or was it severe adverse event? No, I'm sorry, I need to look at it, but it was one of the adverse events. And so basically it's like, even with the numbers they have, it's almost comparable. And then you ask yourself, like, how much are you really worried about your child even getting a COVID-19 infection? And does it even prevent, you know, the infection, or does it just delay it? And we see, it seems like the more we learn about these vaccines, it just delays it. So if it just delays it, really the benefit is questionable. And then it's like, we have these harms that we know of that are, you know, that at least have shown up in these randomized trials of the increased risk of infection and then the adverse events. And, you know, one can sort of quibble with the increased risk of infection and say, oh, well, you know, did you cherry pick your endpoint, and just happen to find this? But no, this is something you were specifically looking at based on your interest. And, you know, you can say that the confidence intervals are wide, you know, but that is, of course, the nature of the randomized trials. Yeah. They were small. And we were just looking at some reviewer comments.
The trials were small, and the number of events are small, what be it COVID infection or alternative right. endpoints that you might be looking at. That's just the nature of it.
But what so basically, we're left with data where we say we actually are not able to at all say that it appears that the benefits outweigh the harms. And really that's what we should, and we're only looking and, you know, we're doing the unfair comparison, right? And these data actually give the benefit of, to the vaccines. As you say, Christine, it gives them an advantage. And so it puts, you know, physicians and parents and anyone else who were thinking about this vaccine and basically, a position where you don't really have enough information to make a decision to say, yeah, I want to get this vaccine. And really anyone who's objectively looking at the data would say, well, why would you take the chance? Because you haven't proven to me that the benefits outweigh the harms.
I think the one caveat I would give to this is that it's honestly no different than in the adult consideration. If you look at the kids that are affected by COVID with a higher probability, there's this very striking obesity gradient that is just, it's striking in anyone under the age of 60, and it's equally striking in kids. These are the kids that are getting hospitalized. How much does a prior infection mitigate that? We have yet to fully describe that, probably a lot. You probably remember that one trial from the New England Journal where one dose was about as effective as two doses in terms of preventing ICU admissions yep. in a fairly high-risk population, meaning that population, like 35% of the kids, if I remember correctly, had been admitted to the hospital sometime in the previous year. This is not an average kid population. And pretending somehow right. that you could take this and apply it as a general recommendation to the general population, it does two things. One thing, one point that it does is it discredits you in the sense that you actually lose credibility with the general population by saying somehow that every child will benefit from this, that this whole notion of quote prior conditions and higher risk is a canard. That's actually it verges on a lie. And then the second part of it is you actually don't really emphasize the importance of this vaccine potentially for certain kids. And I don't mean just morbidly obese kids. A great example would be kids who have major neurologic disabilities, have airway issues, oral aversion, such as kids with Downs who also have abnormalities of cellular and humoral immunity. Another big population is sickle cell kids, these kids who can get severely affected with any sort of viral infection. And they can have a sickle crisis, there's nothing different about COVID in that regard. So it's, you kind of don't emphasize the importance for these kids, where if I have very little doubt that if we were to do a number needed to benefit versus number needed to harm in that population, the numbers would be very clearly in favor for many of these subgroups. Mm. But if, and in fact, by analogy, if we were to just exclude it to just kids with no prior history of any problems who are non-obese, I think the numbers would tip in the other direction even more. So it's almost like we're somehow pretending that it's shocking news that interventions have different benefits in different populations. There's nothing about this that is shocking or novel. In fact, it's pure idiocy to suggest that that's not the case in general.
And
yeah,
that's
I
so
a great
much agree.
Point.
Yeah, and I think that's it's such in stark contrast with the whole concept of personalized medicine, which has also sneaked into vaccinology, where we talked about now personalized vaccinology. And indeed, that is what you are talking about here, some stratified assessment. And I very much agree with your point that it's a disservice to the trust in vaccination programs to promote a vaccine to groups that obviously don't have a big benefit from them to the naked eye, even to, you know, to the overall population. It was quite clear that these vaccines weren't going to prevent very severe illness in children. But that kind of,
right.
It does
and you look
does
at
undermine
like
the trust. Yeah.
Big time. And you look at something like a measles infection where, I mean, people make light of measles and an acute infection, but, you know, SSPE is no joke. What is it? If the rate's about 1 in 600, it presents potentially years down the line. It's debilitating and progressive. And so now, because of this weird thing you did with the word vaccine, like being part of some sort of holy trinity, rather than just being a therapeutic and like any other therapeutic in your armamentarium in clinical medicine, now people are hesitant about a measles vaccine where the risk is broadly distributed. It's not somehow clearly just apportioned to particular risk groups. It's a broadly distributed risk. And you eroded the importance of that. And it's shocking. It's truly shocking.
Yeah. And it is interesting. I mean, the Danish data really bear out what you say with the measles vaccine. And but I totally agree with you with the COVID vaccine. It was like, you know, these children children that don't have underlying health conditions, they have like a 3 per million before at the first time they're infected risk of mortality from it. Like, and that's probably overestimated because of incidental. And so how can you even do the study? I mean, once MISC wasn't a problem, it's like you need millions and millions of children, and then you need to ask yourself, in order to power the study for meaningful outcomes, and then you need to ask yourself, like, should we even be doing the studies? And so my question for you is, you know, how should the studies have been done of the COVID vaccine in children? Should it have only been done in high-risk groups first? I agree with Martin Kulldorff that we probably should have done the trial of the vaccines in elderly adults first, just to even sort of like get this proof of concept, like, you know, because I do wonder children with underlying conditions, unhealthy older adults, they're also more susceptible to side effects, I would imagine. So we cannot assume, you know, that just because they stand to benefit more, that they're not going to also be susceptible to, you know, the adverse events. So
what we have seen for 6 non-live vaccines is this pattern that, as I mentioned, you would be protected against the target disease in an African context, but you would also be more susceptible to other infections in the period afterwards. And what is concerning to me with the results we got out of reanalyzing the phase 3 trials for COVID-19 vaccines in children is this signal of increased threefold statistically significantly higher risk of lower respiratory tract infections, including an independently significant threefold higher risk of RSV infections, which are more severe infections in children than the COVID-19 infections. And again, it's collected right over a shorter time period, so we don't really know the full extent of this effect. So for me, it suggests that there is a dangerous signal. The mRNA vaccines behave like the other non-live vaccines that we have studied. And it taken together with the immunological data that is now coming out of adult and child studies, showing that receiving mRNA vaccines for a period of at least 6 months reduces the innate immune system's capability of responding to viruses. These are in vitro studies, so meaning that this takes place in a petri dish in the laboratory, but they take the cells from immunized people before and after they received mRNA vaccines. And when they put something that looks like a virus or directly simulates a virus infection down to the cells, they simply see that after receiving mRNA vaccines, the cells are more lazy. They don't respond with as many signal molecules, cytokines, etc., as they did before the adults, respectively children, were vaccinated. So if we put this evidence together, it does suggest that perhaps these very immunogenic vaccines actually for a period reduces the immune system capability of handling other infections. So I find this is a signal that needs further scrutinization. And coming back to your question, Tracy, how do we design good studies to address this? I'm just coming from the World Vaccine Congress in Washington, and there are so many new mRNA vaccines in pipeline. You can't believe it. So it's basically for every pathogen that people are now striving to develop mRNA vaccines. So we didn't do it right in the first place when we tested the COVID-19 vaccines, because we vaccinated the control groups very rapidly after the vaccines were deemed effective. We didn't have long follow-up of the vaccinated. We didn't collect, as I've already said, data on other infections and other diseases occurring in the follow-up period of the phase 3 trials, and we didn't do any phase 4 trials. But my take-home message really is that we should use the opportunity with some of the new mRNA vaccines that are now being tested in phase 3 trials and are put to market. And this is a great opportunity to improve on the system for testing vaccines. And we wrote a paper about that last year in drug safety, where we describe how are we currently doing and how is it currently being done in phase 3 trials and post-marketing surveillance, and how should it ideally be done, seen in the light that we now know for sure that vaccines can affect the immune system more broadly and the risk of other infections. And that really includes what would be my recipe for testing the new mRNA vaccines, that follow-up should be at least for 2 years, where you don't vaccinate the controls, at least for 1 year, depending on the urgency. But you should have a randomized comparison of vaccinated versus placebo recipients. It should be a true placebo and not another vaccine. So not, for instance, another mRNA vaccine, so something that wouldn't make sense at all. And then you should collect all health data occurring during follow-up, no matter which type of disease that might occur in the vaccinated or the placebo recipients, no matter whether you believe it's related to the vaccine or not. They should be collected for the full duration of the study. And then there should be post-marketing, once the vaccines have been approved by FDA or similar agencies and they're put into market, there should be an independently conducted, independently from the pharmaceutical industry and the producer of the vaccine, a phase 4 trial with at least cluster randomized randomization to the vaccine or individual randomized vaccination to really ensure large enough numbers to address some of these questions that are important to the recipients of vaccines, which is basically not will I get less of the vaccine disease, but will I be overall healthier in all ways if I take this vaccine than if I didn't do it.
So how do we get the pharmaceutical companies to run trials like that when the FDA is certainly not demanding they do that and the EMA has not been demanding they do that? So is this going to be like the people need to take a stand and say, like, we're not getting these vaccines until we have good data? I mean,
it's depressing.
Right.
I don't know what is it like at the EMA. I mean, we know. I don't know much about it. We know quite a bit about what happens at the. I mean, I do. I mean, I've heard quite a bit about the FDA in terms of the revolving door from regulatory agency to industry. What is the EMA like? I have no idea.
So I'm not the right person to answer that, but I what I know is it's not part of the current system. They are not contemplating that vaccines could affect other diseases than the vaccine disease, and then these typical solicited adverse events in the first weeks that are kind of, you know, trivialized, which maybe that's also justified. We don't, if it's a severe disease, you don't bother that much that you get a slight fever or fatigue with the vaccine if you're then protected against the vaccine disease afterwards. But these are really the only things that are in the minds of the regulators right now. And I think simply they haven't, unfortunately, or the system hasn't kept track with what the research is now showing without any doubt that the vaccines have broader effects.
I mean, one really has to suspect that there's the same sort of bias in the EMA as there is in the FDA, or else they simply follow what the FDA is doing. Because basically what happened in Europe is, you know, the vaccines were approved on a similar time frame, and then it really was up to the individual countries to give the guidelines about who should and shouldn't get vaccinated. And, you know, there were some countries like Sweden that really, you know, questioned the data. And I feel like if countries have sort of a more robust, like independent way of evaluating the data, then you get those different guidelines. But there's so much international pressure, you know, on those countries to sort of conform to what everyone else does. And, you know, my impression is the FDA really sort of like leads the way in terms of what happened. And then, and what happens. And also, you know, we got a lot of our information from Israel, who really, you know, had a contract with Pfizer. And so the data we were getting out of Israel was extremely biased. And so we were all kind of, you know, all our regulatory agencies were really relying on like a highly data biased data that were coming out of Israel. So it is depressing. And it's like, we can sit around and talk about how we want the trials to be designed. But the only thing that we can do is continue to bring attention to it. So I think there's more public pressure on the regulatory agencies to demand those sort of data, or it's just going to simply be a question of, you know, people are just not, the demand won't be there. People will, you know, they'll stop, you know, wanting to take vaccines. And then we see, you know, what we were just discussing, where it's like people just basically stop taking all vaccines. And it sounds like all of us agree on the measles vaccine for sure, that the MMR vaccine. And so, you know, I mean, because we've looked at the data, and I agree with that. I mean, I wanted my children to get vaccinated for that. I guess not everyone is looking independently at the data. So,
and I think to your point, it is depressing because if you control the purse strings, there's not a whole lot more that ends up having influence. And so perhaps, you know, for me, the biggest issue is making sure that individual autonomy isn't violated on bad principle. And so for me, that's really the most important thing. That's the most important moral and ethical, and ultimately, honestly, clinical ethical consideration as well. I mean, I would love for all the recommendations in the world out there to be strongly evidence-based and to have clear guidelines with overall benefit being accrued to populations and who is good, who is it good for, who is it bad for, so cohorts, et cetera, subgroup analysis. But, you know, honestly, this is going to be darn near impossible for a lot of different things, number one. And number two, ultimately, because there's such a industry bias, the amount of funding that comes from industry, the number of people that sit on committees who have resumes that are essentially 50, 70, maybe something 100% that are pharma-sponsored clinical trials, and that's their academic resume, it's depressing. It's absolutely depressing. And so ultimately, I think for me, as long as you want to drink someone's Kool-Aid, it's your decision. But don't force someone else to drink that Kool-Aid, right? And let them find their own truth. And I guess that's where I draw the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a great segue to actually what happened to you, Ron. But I want to let Christine go. Yeah, say what you wanted to say, Christine.
I just say I'm more ambitious. I really understand that you are opposed to mandates. We don't have mandates in Denmark. I don't know how I would deal with it if there were mandates. I I'm so strongly against you can force anybody to take a vaccine. And I think we have to, it's really also not necessary, in my opinion, in the sense that if you have good data, if you have trustworthy health authorities that are transparent about the pros and cons of vaccination, if it's clear that there is a benefit, everybody will, maybe apart from a few percent, will take a vaccine. People are
93% to 95% at least, right? And
yes.
So, for example, you, with respect to mandates, prior to COVID, I had no problem with them. Like, I operated under the simple assumption that people were operating in good faith. And if you really didn't want them, you had a problem. Meaning you had something that you had to resolve for yourself emotionally, educationally, what have you. I've completely turned that around, right? And it was, we all are allowed to learn as we age, and you're never too old to learn. I learned my lesson. I learned my lesson. I no longer support.
But coming back to my ambition, it's not to stop with just not having mandates. I really want us to test vaccines properly in the future. And I think it's largely unknown, but there is a historical example of a high titer measles vaccine that was introduced in Africa. It was protective against measles. It could be given already at 4 to 6 months of age in the presence of maternal antibody. And it was introduced based on data showing that it could give clinical protection against measles and increased, and you had an antibody response. But there were independent researchers testing it against the standard measles vaccine, and out came very consistent results that were also later confirmed by American researchers in Haiti, that the high titer measles vaccine was associated with twofold higher female mortality. So this meant at the scale of Africa at that time that the introduction would have been associated with at least 500,000 excess deaths every year. And this could have gone unnoticed, really. In a continent where people don't really count how many children are born or die, that could have happened. And my fear is, and my concern is, that this could likewise happen in a high-income setting. We would fortunately not see children dying because of negative non-specific effects of vaccine, but we could see increased rates of hospitalizations, infections, etc. And to be honest, we are seeing some of that in the aftermath of COVID. And I'm not saying it's due to the COVID vaccines, but I'm just saying we cannot exclude, based on the present data, that it could not be due to the COVID vaccines. So I think there's a real concern that we might introduce vaccines that are overall harmful. And now it seems we lost Ren, unfortunately.
I know.
Yeah.
Hopefully he'll be back.
Yeah. Anyways, I'll stop there, Tracy, and say, you know, that this is a concern of mine, that we might, if nobody suspects that a vaccine and investigates whether a vaccine could have harmful effects.
He's back. Hold on.
Good to have you
back.
Yeah, my computer just randomly restarted. That was weird. Okay.
Oh,
anyway, sorry about
okay.
that.
Okay, I'll just briefly summarize what I said, Ram, namely the concern that introducing a vaccine could actually unnoticed lead to increased mortality in a low-income setting and morbidity in a high-income setting, where people wouldn't connect the dots necessarily and say, if we are seeing a deterioration or in children's risk, then it could be associated with that vaccine, because it's simply not part of the way we think about vaccines. But it should be, and therefore I want, my ambition is not to stop with having mandates, but really to change the way that vaccines are currently being tested towards a new and better framework.
Just to qualify, it's not so much that I want to eliminate mandates. I actually don't feel strongly about that for most of the mandated vaccines, actually. It's more that if someone wants to bring something new into the fold as a mandate, that's something I'm going to be extremely, extremely skeptical of, and I'm going to be put a high level of scrutiny on it. Whereas previously, I don't think I would have, and I think that's the loss of trust.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I think we disagree on that, Ram, because I think that the vaccination mandates really go against all other, you know, the basic principles of medical ethics, which is one of them is, of course, bodily autonomy. And so we don't treat other, you know, medical interventions the way that we treat vaccines. And of course, for me living in Denmark, I did come to realize that the United States was an outlier. And then for me coming back and basically being told I had to take the influenza vaccine, which was not even being offered to me in Denmark, I was very disturbed. And then also, you know, to have required vaccines for my children that were not even being offered in Denmark for them to attend school in the United States, you really start to question things, right? Looked at the data too and declined some of them already for my kids and coming to California, which really, we don't have to get into the whole history of it.
It's an interesting point. It's a good point. I mean, like I've quite literally had, I've lost count, 28 or 29 influenza vaccines. I can't remember. In fact,
well, you haven't gotten Guillain-Barré yet, apparently.
I haven't melted yet. One season, I apparently got two. I got the regular influenza, I don't know if it's quadrivalent or not, as well as the H1N1. And apparently they slipped another one in there. And I found it absolutely hilarious when people would call me anti-vaxxer. I'm like, exactly how many do you want me to take? I mean, I have smallpox vaccine scars, and I bet you don't. I have probably had many more vaccines than you have had. What is your IQ again? I'm just curious. And so it's absolutely shocking. But anyway, yeah, I get your point, Tracy. I get it.
Yeah.
So
what happened at Stanford? Or just really quick, because I want people to hear. I mean, because it's a crazy story. It's very frustrating to me. It makes me angry.
Well, I mean, for me, as the process went through, we all know about the CMS mandate that came through for the COVID vaccines. So sometime in August, they were asking me, do I want to get it? August 2021, way back in December when it was offered to us, I was very clear on the data and what it showed. I'm like, I don't need this. I'm going to get it. When I get it, I don't know, but I will get it. And there's no strong argument for me to take it. I'm like, you know, there are residents that are clamoring for this who are afraid. There are housekeepers who are, you know, with a BMI greater than 30 and age greater than 50 who would need it far more than I do. They should get it. I don't need it. The data doesn't show it. I really don't want it. I don't think they're sufficient.
This is the first vaccine.
First dose. So, you know, when they push the issue, I'm like, fine, Delta variant out there, you seem to be worried. Okay, fine. You have this deep belief that it stops transmission. There's no evidence for that, but whatever. I'll make you happy. J&J, I'll go ahead and take, you know, J&J. I'll take one shot. It's a fairly traditional adjuvant-based vaccine, and I'll just go ahead and take it. It's fine. So I took it. Life went on. Nobody died. I didn't expect it to. I wasn't worried about it. It was sort of like, you want me to bend the knee? I'll bend the knee. But you know what? And I said this in an email. I said, you know, science shouldn't be dictated by your political views or your affiliation with a particular viewpoint, be it political or be it what is ultimately politicized science. And so the long and the short of it is I took it. Life went on. And then Governor Newsom was the only governor in the United States to issue an act on a booster mandate as Omicron was sort of escalating through. And, you know, I have some fairly intimate information about the conversation that occurred between major health systems in California and the governor's office around the time the booster mandate was initiated in Omicron. And and I don't want to violate the trust of the people who shared that information with me. This is at a very high level, and I would never violate that trust. But having said that, the sort of comments that were made in the meeting that were ultimately shared with me were shocking, frankly, just shocking. The amount of ignorance, the amount of arrogance exhibited by him was absolutely shocking. And so ultimately, the booster mandate went through. My adult pediatrics clinical practice is with Sutter Health. They were okay with providing an exemption. I presented a letter with data and what have you, and they said, yeah, it's fine. And I subsequently helped many other physicians in that system, as well as nurses, by the way. We were in a major nursing crisis, get exemptions. Otherwise, they were going to be released, and Sutter was going to be further short-staffed. And in fact, without naming names, I was asked by some individuals to help some of these physicians and nurses because they didn't want to lose them as staff. Really good physicians, really good nurses. We're talking physicians with 20, 30 years experience with tremendous clinical skills and a lot to offer, supposedly in this in a severe pandemic that was, not supposedly, it was at that time actually straining the system. So then it came around to the booster, and my teen had COVID in January. I think it was January, February of 2022. I subsequently got it from him. We both had a mild infection for a couple of days. My most prominent symptom was a bit of a tracheitis, and finally my antibodies converted positive. Previously, I tested them twice before. They had not. And in fact, before my J&J, I went ahead and got an antibody. While they don't persist all the time, the fact that it was negative, I could justify the decision. Yeah, it makes sense. So now the booster came along. I'd had my infection. The booster mandate deadline was originally February. And I said, no, I really don't need it. And they kind of left me alone at Stanford. And then suddenly in August of, I think, and I'm not sure on all the dates, but somehow around August 2022, they started haranguing me again. And now understand that in this time period, I've been much more active with urgency of normal. I had acted as an expert on behalf of certain organizations that were suing Santa Clara County, as well as the governor's office with respect to certain policies, COVID-related policies that had been enacted. So, you know, in the sense I was politically active. I mean, I was clearly engaging in action that was assisting people who had a political argument with the COVID policy, which was very political. I think we all agree with that. And so they kept pushing this matter, and it was odd to do this in the midst of multiple Stanford faculty who had gotten one, two boosters. I mean, the ER was constantly sending out so-and-so tested positive. Can you cover? Can you do this? Can you do that? And I'm like, really? Are we really doing this? clearly it's not doing what you think it does. And on the other hand, you're saying, well, this is just about protecting patients. And I have other stories I can share around patient protection and patient safety, so to speak. And it's just, so anyway, ultimately, they terminated my clinical privileges. And again, ostensibly, the reason was patient safety in face of just absolutely overwhelming epidemiologic data that makes that claim pretty laughable. And also in the setting of me being very politically active and, as Tracy knows, testifying in Sacramento, being involved in these other cases, talking to Santa Clara County commissioners. Jay and I were quite involved in trying to get some EMS folks rehired after not taking the vaccine. And it was
Jay Bhattacharya.
Yeah, Jay Bhattacharya. Yeah. So the timing, in my opinion, wasn't simply about patient safety. So that's my summary view of this.
And so you decline the booster,
yeah,
and then you lose your clinical job.
Correct.
At Stanford.
Correct.
Where you had done your undergrad, you did your PhD, and you'd been at you had very high patient ratings, I noted, and had not had issues
for an ER physician. So, for an ER physician.
Yeah.
ER physicians get plastered in patient ratings. Nobody is happy with it ever. But anyway,
I know, that's why I was so impressed. And then they fire you over a booster that doesn't really seem to work. And I mean, that's obviously their loss, but you know, I mean, it is, it's incredible. It's incredible how many people it happened to, and it's very sad for the healthcare system.
It is really bad for the healthcare system. And, you know, one of the things, I'm not going to say the physician that said this to me, but one of the things they told me is, you should have just faked it like so many other doctors. And I said, what? Mm. And I was honestly shocked by that, because that it's a felony. And, you know, for the it doesn't take, the medical board doesn't recognize, you don't have to be convicted of a crime for the medical board to actually have an issue with you and your professional license. They operate beyond the purview of simply the law. And there are lots of good reasons for that. And I'm not criticizing that at all. What I'm actually referring to is the fact that any physicians would so brazenly lie about something like that. I find it to be both partly a little cowardly, but also just unethical. Like, what else were you willing to falsify? Right. Are there medical records you'll falsify? Because that's what you just did, just to be clear. You falsified a medical record, and that's what you just did knowingly. So I understand what people did. They had livelihoods at stake, and I get it. But I'm actually was really shocked to hear that. I just couldn't do that. I just couldn't do it. So anyway, this goes to my point of taking a stand around the mandates, Christine. So it's kind of like, I got to this position. I'm like, look, you know, you need to have a higher bar if you're going to mandate something. And you folk, your bar was political. Your bar was socio-political at the very least. And that's not a good enough bar to mandate a medical intervention. And by the way, I would say that argues that I use that same argument for childbirth. Your socio-political bar isn't a good reason to mandate childbirth on someone, right? So I'm fairly consistent about it, and I'm not trying to get political, but the point is I'm fairly consistent about it. And it's kind of why I'm a bodily autonomy absolutist, Tracy, to your point.
Excellent. Well, I mean, you were proven right. I mean, you were right at the time. I mean, and I completely agree with you. And I'm glad that you stood by your principles and made it clear. I'm glad that you were honest about, you know, not taking it, because, you know, Martin Kulldorff was, I mean, Aaron Cariotti, he was for the first dose. So it was same rationale, like already had the infection. And, you know, the fact that this happened to so many respected scientists, you know, within the academic community and in clinical medicine. I mean, I really do actually think it proved it exposes a very important point. And it shows that you can stand up for yourself, and the importance of doing that. But so, well, thank you for doing that.
I would also sharing that story. From the European perspective, your stories, both of your stories and those of Martin and others, are just terrible and incomprehensible. And I don't think, just coming from the US and after 14 days there and talking with people, it became clear to me that very few in the US actually know about how the situation was in Europe, and that nobody, well, apart from a few countries, mandated vaccines and put that pressure on people, and the firings are just unbelievable. So I think from Europe, we look at the US as a place where science fell off the stairs, and I don't know what prevailed. It wasn't science, and
I
don't know how many Americans actually are aware that you're a complete outlier, or the U.S. is a complete outlier, sort of on the global scale here. It seemed to me, I was surprised that so few people were aware that what is happening in the U.S. right now is considered by the rest of the world super strange. And
it's really interesting. It's like, you know, when I go back to my point I made earlier, like, I've now hit, you know, 30 vaccines over, you know, 27 years or whatever it is, and, you know, over 25 influenza vaccines. I don't know how many. That's literally how. I just don't know. And I don't argue about it because so many billions of doses have been given. I'm well aware of antigenic fixation. I'm well aware of those things that can happen. They can happen with an infection and a vaccination. I get all of that. But my general calculus for an influenza vaccine is there are so many billions of doses given. It is a very low harm vaccine. It's probably relatively low benefit too. I get that. But having said all that, it was absolutely fascinating to encounter people where suddenly this vaccine became the line that they would draw. And it was not a biological line. It clearly wasn't. It was socio-political. And pretending that it was about health and public health, it was farcical, absolutely farcical. And I, once again, I go back to my phrase, I don't know if you're a liar or an idiot, but you're one of those, and neither of those I can respect. So it just, and I don't mince words. I think that's pretty obvious. But like, and I'm not apologetic about that. There's no reason not to call something exactly what it is.